Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-11-317, Minton v. Quintal. Arguing for the petitioner, Charles S. Lotov. Also appearing for the petitioner, Jack F. Schweigert. Arguing for the respondent, Curtis Sherwood. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed with your arguments today? Mr. Sherwood? In my understanding, Mr. Lotov, you reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so when there's 10 minutes to go in your argument, we'll have a yellow light will come on and let you know that you're eating into your rebuttal time, and that's warning to you. Mr. Sherwood, we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go in your argument so you know you're nearing the end. All right. Mr. Lotov, please proceed.
Your Honor, thank you first for rescheduling the hearings this morning.
Absolutely.
In all essence, this case involves two words, explicit and internal. Explicit is the word that's used in Green versus McElroy to describe the obligation of the government to have explicit authorization before a government agent, before a government official or agency can do something in the order of affecting substantial employment opportunities for an individual. Green's conclusion is that not only must there be explicit authorization, but that authorization must not only cover the person who's given the authorization, but cover the procedures that the person is supposed to use. And this is to safeguard the fundamental liberty, the liberty interest of having an employment opportunity to choose one's own profession. This case certainly involves that kind of opportunity because Mr. Quintal, Mr. Minton, and Mr. Stanley were professional stagehands who'd been in that business for more than 30 years. They were people who worked exclusively in the Blaisdell and the Waikiki Shell, and they worked to advance and to get together a book of business from clientele, from people who repeatedly requested them through their union. When this ended, because of this ardor by Mr. Quintal, their careers came to a grinding halt. It certainly cannot be said that this is a miscellaneous employment decision that left them with other opportunities, because they had learned how to operate the Blaisdell sound system, how to operate its props, how to do everything that had to be done. And Mr. Minton in particular, because he was the crew chief, the person who's in charge of directing the other crews, the other stagehands, he was the person who would normally be requested by promoters and hired by them to do this kind of work. To say that he could have gotten some job at some other facility is nonsense, because the other facilities that are named, suggested by the defendants, the appellees, are miscellaneous small places where big productions requiring stagehands are not normally put on. Getting back to the concept of explicit authorization, it's not just that there's got to be some kind of business that the government official performs. It's got to be that there's an explicit authorization to do this kind of thing, to implicate and to destroy the employment opportunity of an individual. That's got to be included in the explicit authorization. Without it, Green is not adhered to. Now, we've talked a lot in the briefs about this other particular facet, which is the internal management exception. I want to stress that Green has nothing about that at all. In Green, if you've got it, you've got it. If you've got the explicit authorization, you've got it. And in this case, there's no explicit authorization at all. All there is a general consul, charter approval that this person is the director of this department and has general authority to operate buildings. This is very general. Nobody could call this explicit. Explicit means you've got to be able to do two things. One, direct who's working for which employer. This is far cry from a situation which you might have where, just as an incident, a necessary incident even, to employment, to being an official, you have the right to decide employment decisions for your own employees within your department. This is different. This is analogous to a situation where you might have the city parks department director who's authorized to send a crew of three or four or however how many he decides to send to plant a tree in a park. But it's certainly different from when you have the parks director, use an example that was on the news last night, the parks director is in charge of the YPO soccer team. But can he say, this is the girls' soccer team from Waikoloa, their coaches once before sent somebody out on the field when they shouldn't have, an assistant coach, therefore he's banned from participating in this particular soccer meet. And that's more analogous to what happened in our case. One of the most interesting things...
This was a lot more than one soccer meet.
Well, yeah, and that makes it more worse, because they're banning them permanently. And that's the thing that really is disturbing about the Intermediate Court of Appeals decision, which used the word, what was it, not temporary, but suspend. How could they say that? These people were banned permanently. The only thing that was less than a permanent ban was the fact that Quintel later on said, I might reconsider after 6 months, or I think it was a year or something, which gives them the opportunity to say, oh no, I didn't bother, whatever he wants to. This gets me to the wonderful question of what happened as far as due process is concerned. And I think it's been briefed sufficiently, but if you want to know what really happened, all you have to do is look at the transcript of the hearing on the second day of the motion for preliminary injunction. This transcript reveals the most disgusting, ridiculous misunderstandings of what was done and why it was, and they come out saying things like this: Mr. Minton had directed or permitted a stagehand to come on stage when the mayor was singing, and that this caused an interruption to the mayor's microphone. This is the same thing that they've come up with, and they thought this was even the case months later when they had the preliminary injunction hearing. They still were under that total misconception, which at the trial was shown to be completely wrong. This is the thing that not only in this case requires that there be a procedural due process, but that the procedural due process be meaningful. And the fact that they made such blatant mistakes and were under such terrible misconceptions even months later shows that if they had given these due process protections, if they had had a legitimate hearing, they would have known better.
Mr. Lotsoff, so what process should they have been given? A full-blown hearing with a neutral person, or what are you proposing?
Well, I'm proposing, first of all, that there has to be an authorization in some kind of legislative mandate to give them the rights to do any of this. But beyond that, once they've got that right, whatever it may be, it has to meet procedural due process requirements, which would be primarily the right of confrontation, the right to cross-examine, the right to be present, the right to hear the evidence against them, the right to put on proof. All of these things were missing. What really happened here is Quintel went to a meeting with Donovan Ahuna, the business manager of the union, and a man by the name of Omo, who is the president of the union, and said, these guys are banned. And that was it.
Was it improper, in your view, for Mr. Quintal to work through the union representatives? What's your assessment of the fact that the two employees here were members of a union, and there was certainly a practice, if not a formalized understanding, that the city would work through the union in dealing with matters affecting the members of the union? Is that what? In other words, in your view, was it inappropriate to work through the union representatives, or should they have been doing so, and why would they not Why would it not have been appropriate for them to do so, given the history at this workplace?
Well, first of all, the history of the workplace is that the union was the conduit through which jobs were signed, and in many cases, not all, by any means not all, but in many cases, the city would refer promoters to the union when promoters needed, or music directors or whoever needed stagehands. That's the extent of the history of the process. It isn't like there's a union that's established and has a relationship with the city that's ongoing and that the calls for the union to be the interface between the employers and the city. The city is kind of out in third field because all it's doing is referring promoters and people like that to the union. And this is probably for political reasons because it's good for the city to endorse.
Well, do you think the city was in any way required to work through the union rep, or should it, in your view, have gone directly to the employees and not communicated with the union representative at all?
Well, I think the first thing they should have done is found out what the employees wanted. And instead of just not even telling the employees that they're under investigation or anything, they should have certainly alerted the employees directly and then given the employees the right to choose whether they wanted to be represented by the union, by an attorney, by whoever they want. And that should have been their prerogative, and the city's officials took that prerogative away from them.
You know, following up on the Chief Justice question, the finding of fact 29 describes the union's capacity. It says something like, he is responsible, Donovan Ahunov, for handling the union's business affairs by representing its membership's interests in discussions and negotiations with employers. Is the city saying that there are these guys' employers, Minton? I mean, the responsibility talks about negotiating with employers. So I'm wondering how that has anything to do with the city interaction.
Well,
this finding doesn't justify, in my view, the city working through the union to sanction Minton and Stanley.
Well, that's very correct. Of course not. Okay. It's bizarre that anybody would jump to that conclusion. That's wrong.
Mr. Lotsoff, what are you seeking here today? You want us to set aside the trial judge's decision and then remand for a new trial?
Well, no. I don't think a new trial is necessary, certainly not on the liability situation. It's got to be reversed completely as far as liability is concerned. And I think with the evidence that we've got and with the trial already behind us, there's no question that there was a violation of Green and a violation of every concept that we can muster. It does have to be.
What about damages then?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It does have to be remanded, and that's because the trial judge, perhaps for good measure, perhaps to make sure that his judgment wouldn't be set aside so easily, or perhaps honestly to discourage the appeal, found that there were no damages because there was speculative evidence only. And the speculative evidence was overwhelmingly that there was definite, clear damage, and that has to be redetermined. The damage, particularly in specific clients, Mr. Stanley was supposed to, the day after he was informed of the ban, start work on a project for The Lion King, which by all testimony would have ended with him earning more than $28,000.
Go ahead.
There are other parts of regarding the testimony regarding loss of wages that were not so definite.
Well,
so what is your proposal? I mean, does the whole thing go back for retrial on damages? Are the stipulations that the city and county entered into still viable, or regarding the economist?
Well, I think that's true, that the stipulations are viable. They were stipulated that the economist was qualified. They didn't stipulate to his results, of course, but my petition and my appeal, everything, asked that the court determine, based on the law, based on the citations that we've mentioned, that this is not speculative evidence and that it should be considered as for its a merit. There's so much evidence that damages were really not only projected, as Dr. Laudat projected, using standard methods that have always been accepted, but that there was actual direct people. I mean, even the Catholic Church wanted Mr. Minton. Not only did they want him, but they wrote asking for an exception so he could do a certain project.
Getting back to the damage, I thought Dr. Luda, is that how his name is pronounced?
Lauda.
Wasn't he initially retained by the city and then both sides were using him?
Right. There was a stipulation that both sides would use him. And that's particularly difficult because when he reached his conclusions, the city, I guess, didn't like it and argued that he was, well, I don't know what exactly they argued. But the judge found that it was speculative. I don't know how it could be speculative. This is a standard method. And I would ask to answer this question by Judge Justice Nakamura.
Nakayama,
sorry. that the answer to the question is that this court would be asked to specifically rule that in the question of damages, this kind of evidence is permissible, it's legally acceptable, and that Dr. Laudat's report should have been given some credence, maybe not to the extent that it's literally got to be used for every down to the penny, but that it's got to be used properly and given sufficient respect. And then, of course, I can't keep getting back to this big particular exception to the general equation where Mr. Stanley was supposed to start work the day after the ban. How can that be ignored? And I'd like to ask the court respectfully to address that particular exception too, as far as the question of damage is concerned, and give the trial judge some direction as to what should be thought about, what the law is covering the damages in this kind of a situation. That's the answer to that question. I began by saying that there's two words that have a big importance in this case, and one of them was explicit, and I think that's possibly dispositive of the whole case. But the other word is internal, because in Chapter 91 of Hawaii Rise Statutes, dealing with administrative procedure law, in Chapter 91 there's an exception for internal management. And internal management means whatever it means, but it certainly doesn't mean management that affects other people. And the wording of Chapter 91, Section 91-4, explicitly refuses to include that kind of factor. It says if it doesn't affect the public, and this of course did. Getting back to my example with the soccer field, if there were a direction from the city parks director that affected the park itself or the planting of the tree, fine. But if it goes so far as to affect another person's rights, it's not exempted by the internal management exception. And that's really all I have to say.
Can I ask, there seems to be some dispute between the parties as to whether the city disparaged or shared the reasons for the ban outside of its interactions with the union and the plaintiffs themselves. Do you have a position on that? In other words, did the employer stigmatize the employees by repeating the reasons for the fact that they were banned, or did it simply, in its dealings with the external parties who asked for their services or who might have come forward later on to ask for help at this venue, did it explain why they were banned or simply that they were not permitted to work there?
Well, the letters are in evidence, and they simply say they're not permitted to work there. Okay. Of course, that in and of itself is a disparaging factor. But I don't feel that that's really an important issue in the case, because stigma plus, or whatever you want to call it, is not an element when you've got a situation where you've got somebody whose band encompasses all of the work that they do. And I call
upon... But isn't it part of having a liberty interest in your right to pursue your chosen profession? So isn't a stigma an important part of that?
Well, the stigma is an important part of that, indeed. But in this particular case, where there's so much evidence that they couldn't pursue their profession, that 90% of their work disappeared as a result of this direct ban, somehow or other, that aspect doesn't seem very important anymore. If that's an indirect way under the Roth case of getting around the idea that there's no direct evidence of harm. But under that logic, I think we don't need to even go there, because there's so much evidence of direct damage. Look at the testimony of Sean Christensen, a person who knew the business, and said, these guys are at the top of their game. These guys are the people we come to, we other stagehands come to for help and instruction. And these guys were the ones that got banned and lost 90% of their work. That's all we need to know. The implications of some kind of character assassination, even though it's true, because you ban somebody like that, it's going to have that effect.
Didn't that letter that banned, the August 31st letter, didn't it talk directly about Mr. Minton's and Mr. Stanley's professionalism? It said that their conduct showed a complete disregard in professionalism. That sounds to me, and that wasn't just mailed to Mr. Minton and Mr. Stanley, that went to the union.
Yeah, the union, the people who, Donovan Ahuna, the business management, he's the one who chose and selected these jobs and told them
But did it go to any other promoters?
I don't believe so. I have no evidence that it did. But as Judge Pollack mentions, this is the most damaging person you could possibly send it to.
I mean, there's no confidential or anything like that on this. It's just, it's off to the union, and nothing saying, you know, the contents of this letter should remain. There's nothing like that.
Well, that's true. But as I say, sending it to the union, the people who select people and assign the union members to jobs, that would be the most damaging person in the world that it could be sent to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lotsoff. Mr. Sherwood, your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Deputy Corporation Counsel Curtis Sherwood, and I represent Pelley's. Contrary to appellant's suggestion, and in this I'm referring to the petition for certiorari, this case does not involve the specter of fascism or even arbitrary and capricious decision-making. This case is about a reasonable decision made by the director of the City's Department of Enterprise Services in order to preserve the goodwill and professional reputation of the city's entertainment locales, and in response to a scathing report by a show's promoter, together with several complaints made by the same show's patrons, describing a musical performance at its concert hall in which the sound was described as, quote, very bad, unquote. To be more specific, the promoter complained of a high-pitched and irritating hissing sound which occurred throughout the show, as well as instances of feedback and cutoff of sound on several occasions.
Did he ever accuse Stanley or Minton of being responsible for that poor sound?
Yes, that was part of his testimony at trial, Your Honor. That's what he included in that term professionalism that you mentioned earlier. That included this, his responsibility for the sound that occurred.
I thought he testified that he was satisfied with the response, and that he did not hold them responsible. And you know, the first thing that strikes me is that I thought that the ban had nothing to do with the sound. I thought that's what Quintal testified to. It had to do with their demeanor, not standing up, and things like that?
I think it was both, Your Honor. I believe it was both, and I believe the record bears that out. But you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
But that's certainly what the ICA decision reached as well.
As the Quintal said, it wasn't technical issues, but demeanor in dealing with customers who were asking for their professional support.
And that was part of the sound check at the rehearsals, that there was problems with the sound, and those promoter, the people that participated in the rehearsals asked for their assistance in hammering out or those problems in which they received some sort of a rude response from Mr. Minton.
Why wouldn't there be a liberty interest implicated here, given the amount of work that the evidence appeared to establish that these two individuals had at the Blaisdell and at the Shell? Why wouldn't a restriction on their ability to work at those two venues be sufficient to impair their liberty interests?
Well, contrary to appellant's position, I think the ICA and the appellee's position is the correct one, in that you have to have something analogous to the Green case, where you have an aeronautical engineer basically can't work for anyone at that profession because he needs a security clearance.
I think that's a very apt analogy. You have the Green case on one side, and you have the cook who comes to the military base on the other side, who's absolutely free to go anywhere where she wanted to go to ply her trade, and you have the aerospace engineer who is, because he doesn't have a security clearance, can no longer really work in that industry, although presumably could go work for a commercial airline company, but for whatever reason isn't able to. What's your response to the argument that the two plaintiffs here seem much closer to Mr. Green than they do to the cook in the other case, because the place where they ply their trade is at the Blaisdell, primarily at the Blaisdell and the Shell, and they're not able to do that?
Well, obviously the appellant's arguments place their emphasis on these percentages that they testified to at court. And if I could correct appellant's attorney, I don't believe Mr. Christensen himself testified to that percentage. I think it was simply the two appellants that testified to that. And we have something very different here.
Christensen said that 90% of their employment came from the Shell and NBC. That was his testimony.
I stand corrected, Your Honor. But what we have, what the difference that we have here is that these particular individuals are qualified to work other places, and they deliberately choose not to do so. It's in the record. It's in their trial testimony. I know that appellant's counsel is labeled the city as having some sort of monopoly on theaters and the ability to have shows here in Honolulu. Certainly not the case. We have the Hawaii Theater. We have a number of local theaters, including the Manoa Theater, the military theaters.
But those theaters don't compare in size and scope to what the city has in the old Blaisdell and the Shell.
I think the White Theater does, Your Honor. And if I may, with regard to concerts, I think actually the Aloha Stadium is probably the largest venue that any particular performer could choose. There's certainly a number of places for these individuals to work. And they.
Do you recall how many times he said he'd worked at, you mentioned Manoa Valley Theater, you recall? There was specific testimony that he'd never worked at Diamond Head Theater, Doris Duke Theater, Manoa Valley Theater, Richardson Theater, and the Mamiya and Kennedy Theaters. Apparently they use students generally.
But I think the important point, Your Honor, is that he has not been precluded from working at those places by anything that the city has done.
The standard is effective preclusion from pursuing your chosen profession. There's two prongs. You can either be absolutely banned, which he was, at the city, the four venues of the city, including the Shell and the both the concert hall and the arena and the exhibition halls. And alternatively, if the effect of what the city has done effectively precludes him from pursuing his employment or his career, that's the other way to violate a liberty interest.
I think the court is referring to one of the two cases that plaintiff named in his reply, and I think that's the D.C. Circuit case, I believe, the court's referring to. Obviously, there's a split, at least we recognize a split among the circuits between at least the Eighth Circuit and the D.C., and there obviously may be more circuits involved. But we would ask that the court follow the Sutton opinion, which the ICA followed as well. And in that opinion,
do you think they were treated fairly?
I believe they were, Your Honor.
Why?
Because in my opinion, I don't believe there was no right to due process here, but even so, even though there was no right, they were afforded a minimum of due process by through their union, by being informed of what the grievances were against them and being able to recount that. And
so you look at the entire record here and you think they were treated fairly?
I do, Your Honor. Under the
lifetime ban. And, you know, one of the arguments that strikes me as I was looking at this is the city's arguing, you know, we have this reputation. We have to preserve what we're to keep them economically valuable. These are forums and arenas that we rent. We have to make sure things are done well. And I'm wondering, who was the one that built up this reputation? These two folks have been there for 50 years total, and we see letter after letter in the record saying these guys have been doing wonderful work, but the Hawaii Catholic schools said they were there 2005, 2006, to 2007. So this reputation that you're trying to preserve, it looks like to me they're the ones who helped build it.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that that's the case. Obviously, there are a number of performances that occur at the concert hall. I don't think it's fair on the record that's been developed thus far to attribute it all to appellants.
I wasn't attributing all of it to it.
But how can you say they were treated fairly when at the time the ban was implemented, they had no idea that the mayor was one of the ones who was complaining about their unprofessional conduct? And at the time they responded to the initial complaint brought by the promoter, it had to do with the sound issues. And then it morphed into unprofessional conduct, and they never had a chance to even respond to that.
Well, Your Honor, if the mayor played any role in the decision, then I would agree with you that it was unfair. But we have testimony at the trial court level that the mayor did not play a role in the decision, that it was Mr. Quintal's decision of his own, that he considered the factors in determining whether or not to restore these individuals.
Who called the meeting with the mayor?
I believe it was the mayor, Your Honor, according to the record.
So you don't think politics intruded at all?
Not on the record that we have. Obviously,
I'm asking you whether you think politics intruded at all.
I don't believe so. If I could get back to your point, Mrs. Pollack. I'll have to skip it. I've lost it now.
Mr. Sherwood, what didn't even Mr. Quintal at one point in time say, gee, maybe the lifetime ban is too long, we should consider something shorter?
Thank you, Justice Nakayama. That's exactly what I was getting at. There was trial testimony. This was not a lifetime. It was not meant to be a lifetime ban. Mr. Quintal testified that he went to the union and his intention was that this be temporary, but he wanted some assurances that this sort of thing would not happen again. He wanted some training for these individuals if he was going to welcome them back into the NBC, that this sort of thing would not happen again.
Well, I think the record says something like this. On August 30th, when he first met with them and he told them about the oral ban, and he said to them, to Ahuna and Omo, that Minton and Stanley were no longer permitted to work at the NBC facilities. And then they asked, suspended for a while? How long? And he said he'd get back to them. And the next day came the letter with the lifetime ban. The only statement that I saw in the record was in his internal memo to himself when he says, oh, I'm thinking of a 9-month suspension. But I don't think that was conveyed to anybody, and it certainly wasn't transformed from a ban to a suspension.
Well, it never ultimately was, Your Honor, but I believe it was conveyed to the union, and I think it's in the record that he did that. Unfortunately, in Mr. Quintal's testimony, it certainly never came to fruition because the union was not willing to go along with that.
There's a formal offer?
There was discussion between Mr. Quintal and the union. I don't know if it was reduced to writing, Your Honor, but there was testimony about that.
Was it, in your view, appropriate for Mr. Quintal to be working through the union or not in these circumstances, in the city's view?
In the city's view, it certainly was. What other purpose is there for a union other than to represent its workers? And I think it was entirely appropriate for them to do that.
Did there not come a point, though, when it became apparent that these two employees were represented by counsel, and at that point, would it not, did their attorney not make clear that he was representing them? I believe the union actually said, well, at this point, we really can't do much with you anymore, city, because now these folks have their own attorneys. And I guess the question would be, from that point forward, were any of these offers or discussions about settlement made?
I'm not entirely clear at that point, Your Honor.
So your argument is that it's okay for the city to ban somebody and work through a union, never inform them of what they're accused of, because the sanction was apparently for their conduct and not the sound, never meet with them, never inform them what the possible sanctions, this is all okay, and just do it through a union rep with no written report or anything? This is how the city normally does things?
I don't think this was a normal circumstance, Your Honor.
In fact, there was testimony that this was the first ban that Mr. Christensen had ever even heard of.
Yes, Your Honor, but there was also testimony that this was the first negative review of such a stand that had been received by this department in decades, I believe. This was an unusual circumstance which took place.
What about principles of progressive discipline? You're familiar with the notion in the labor and employment context that employees, all other things being considered, the initial punishment or initial disciplinary action should be moderated, and disciplinary action, depending on the nature of the complaint, of course, would progressively become more serious. In this instance, you don't have an incident of theft, you don't have workplace violence, you have concerns about professionalism, but why would it be reasonable in this instance for a decision maker to, in essence, impose the maximum possible sanction?
Simply because of the substantial interest that the city that's involved with the city and its reputation. I believe Mr. Quintal testified about the business environment that exists and the fact that it's grown more competitive, and that the Department of Enterprise Services is the only department that's self-sustaining. In order for it to work in that manner, it has to continue to receive income to be competitive in this marketplace. And by allowing these individuals to continue to work there, it's basically placing its reputation in jeopardy.
So despite nearly 50 years combined of all excellent reports of the person who lodged the initial complaint, Arias, who said he said he never had a complaint with those two, and he'd be happy to take them back. So, in spite of all of that, even assuming that there was issues of professionalism, a probationary, a suspension, a requirement of taking classes, or even saying, hey, you can only work with promoters who request you. I mean, all of these possible alternatives, the appropriate step was a lifetime ban.
As I mentioned to Your Honor, the director's intention was to be temporary, but he could not be assured that this sort of mishap would never happen again by the union.
There was actually a letter. There was the letter that he never even responded to right after he imposed this, when the union actually wrote him. This is a September 4th letter, and it says, look, can you suspend this for a while? Can we sit down and talk about it and get at this? And he never even responded to this or the next three or four letters that were written. That's what's in the record.
Yes, Your Honor. I would urge this court, as I mentioned, to draw a distinction between the employment cases quoted by appellant and the ones that we have quoted. Specifically, the Sutton case drew distinction between government employment and the opportunity to do business with those seeking government-insured mortgages. There it says that membership on the panel is not government employment. Rather, it simply represents the opportunity to do business with those seeking government-insured mortgages. Similarly, access to the NBC and the Shell is not government employment. It simply represents the opportunity to do business with private companies putting on performances and exhibitions there.
Didn't the government kind of wiggle its way into all of this by not only implementing the ban, it enforced the ban and said you cannot work at a government-owned venue?
It did, Your Honor, but I think it did properly within the internal workings exception, and that's where I take issue with Pelley's statement of the law. Basically, their position is that anytime it affects a private individual outside of the employment of the government, that it doesn't fall into that exception. Yet we have these two cases that are decided by this court that involve individuals. We have both the Sharma case and the Holdman case. In the Holdman case, we have a private individual trying to go into the correctional facilities and who was forbidden from doing so. She invoked her privacy rights or equal protection rights. Her rights were arguably infringed, but they fell under the internal maintenance exception, and so that was proper. She didn't have a hearing. She was just banned from coming in that manner. And by the same token, we have the Sharma case, which also affected a private individual that conducted business with the government. But the court did not claim that the internal workings exception did not apply. I know that the court has made some question about damages. I would like to just touch upon those, because I do believe it was brought out in the record, and I think the trial court's rulings are proper in finding that damages are speculative because of the nature of the industry, because their employment depends on shows coming to Hawaii, not only coming to Hawaii, but then selecting city venues, and then not bringing their own cast or crew with them.
What about the Lion King, the one that Mr. Lotsoff talked about, and that it seemed like a pretty much of a done deal? Would you even say that that's speculative?
To some extent, Your Honor. Obviously, it's more concrete. I think he testified he was slated to work that
the next day.
Correct, Your Honor. But
and the Hawaii Teachers, State Teachers Association, October 8th, the Hawaii Catholic Schools sent letters, HPU.
Those two examples, Your Honor, obviously far less speculative than the nature of the industry. But plaintiff or appellants have to jump through significant hoops and envision certain events coming to light in order to claim that there's entitled to the damages that they've sought.
How high is this loop? I'm wondering what this loop is.
What about qualified immunity? What is the your position on behalf of the employees here who are facing potentially individual liability?
Both Mr. Director Quintal and Mr. Furman are both entitled to both the state qualified immunity, also known as conditional privilege, and federal qualified immunity with regards to any federal claims against them. And obviously, if one looks at the precedent here, it's not clear. And that's, I think, it should be evident to the court grappling with what was specifically mandated by the law. And at least for qualified immunity, the federal defense, it has to be clearly established that they're violating someone's rights. And whether they were entitled to a procedural due process or not, obviously, we're taking the position that Sutton law, Sutton case controls out of the Eighth Circuit. They're taking the position that the D.C. cases control. It was not clearly established. I don't think either of us have.
Well, we have state law on qualified immunity. Why would we go outside?
It
seems very similar.
It is similar, Your Honor. But I think appellants have even a higher hurdle to jump there because they have to show malice by clear and convincing evidence. And I think the findings of fact of the court below was that there was not malice. And obviously, you can read in to the facts if you believe that the mayor was involved. But the trial court heard all of the testimony, it read all of the exhibits, and it determined that there was no malice involved. I think Director Quintal specifically testified at trial that he wanted to make his decision free from emotion. And that's according to him what he did. And so therefore, I think both of these defendants are entitled to conditional privilege and qualified immunity.
What do you make of the letter that Furman wrote after Justice McKenna instituted, she granted the preliminary injunction, and then even after that, Stanley wrote a letter saying, we want two other people. Do you recall that?
I recall reading that in the trial.
What do you make of that?
Obviously, it's not the best facts to have occurred. But I'm not sure that it was done with malice.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you've acknowledged that.
How about the question of whether the city repeated beyond the union or the plaintiff's allegations as to why they were being banned from the premises? What's the city's position with regard to that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did the city disseminate more broadly the reasons for the blacklisting beyond, or the alleged blacklisting? I guess it depends on, it certainly is a ban, whether you call it a blacklist or not, I guess is another matter. But the ban, did the city disseminate to promoters, others in the community, the reasons for the ban, or was that, or were those reasons limited only to being shared with the plaintiffs and their union?
I believe it was only shared with the plaintiffs and their union, Your Honor. And again, we're not talking about the sort of cases that have been dealt with. We're talking about dishonesty. But even the Paul case, where we have an individual arrested for shoplifting and his profile is photograph was circulated among the community, and he was subsequently dismissed for any shoplifting charge. The court said that was insufficient to to constitute a deprivation of his liberty in order to invoke a due process, his right to due process.
But isn't the implication of an absolute ban? You know, it had been a suspension or it had been something else, you know, you can't work with certain promoters or whatever it was, but when you impose an absolute lifetime ban, the implication is that there must have been something really serious. You know, reading what Justice McKenna said when she conducted that hearing, she said, I'm going to continue this because there must be more here. And then she said, boy, this is such overreaching because, you know, I thought there was some acts of violence or profane language or something like that. And when you do an absolute ban, and there's most people would assume if the government acts to do a lifetime ban that they did accord due process, and yet there was none, and you do a lifetime ban, people are going to interpret like these people must have done something really terrible.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the letter actually uses the word lifetime. It may say they're banned from those facilities, but I think...
Is the ban still in effect?
As far as I know, it is, Your Honor.
And if we affirmed, then it will be still in effect.
Your Honor, by the other side of the token, if appellants prevail in their arguments, a new category of protection would be created. There would be a right to work at public facilities even if there is no civil service and no contractual connection or obligation. I think it's important to highlight that appellants, the cases that they cite are largely based on where there are government contracts involved. And courts probably aware that in federal employment, being able to be a federal contractor is somewhat onerous task. And as the courts rightly recognize, that's a change in that can be a change in legal status.
So
isn't what we have here.
So your argument, it's better because those cases may have arisen in those kind of situations. It's better to allow the government to be able to impose lifetime bans without due process.
In certain circumstances, obviously, this doesn't.
In these circumstances.
Right.
Well, he's not banned from all city venues.
He's not,
the,
Your Honor.
Just
those two places, NBC and the show.
And they were capable of working in other venues, is that correct?
Absolutely. There's nothing to say
they couldn't.
You're
qualified?
Yes.
Other than what the petitioners testified to at the trial, that they didn't work in any of those other facilities, was there any other evidence about the other facilities?
Well, I'm not certain exactly what facilities you're talking about, Your Honor. I know that...
Well, the Doris Duke Theater, all the ones that you've listed in your brief.
Except for Hawaii Theater. They did testify that they worked there. In fact, I think Mr. Stanley said he worked there the previous year or the previous spring, rolling out the Stomp musical. And I think Mr. Minton also testified that he had worked there on a yellow card event.
If you just wrap up briefly, your time's up, so you can have a moment to sum up if you wish.
We believe this is a matter of controlling and managing those individuals who use its facilities. Obviously, this is an unusual circumstance where we have city facilities that are placed in trust of other individuals that are not employed by the city, and therefore, this does fall under the internal exemption. If I could just state one thing quickly, I did not address the specific authorization argument that opposing counsel made. I think the ICA correctly inferred that authorization from the language of the charter. And I would also point the court to plaintiff's own case that he cites, Gonzalez versus Freeman, in which the same argument was made with regard to Congress. Congress has no explicit provision for debarring contractors doing business with commodity credit. Nevertheless, the court reasoned that Congress had set forth the purpose of the commodity credit to aid in the development of foreign markets and agricultural commodities, and without such power, this power to debar and to deal with irresponsible bidders and contractors, the efficiency of the commodity credit's operations would be severely limited. Similarly, here the city.
Oh, Mr. Sherwood, now you're just kind of giving argument. I was giving you the. I gave you a limited opportunity because we'd been asking you questions. So, any final thoughts, or have we pretty much covered it?
We've covered it all.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Lotsoff. How much time does Mr. Lotsoff have remaining?
7 minutes and okay. 18 seconds.
I won't need much.
Pull the mic down if you could.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Lotsoff, if there is evidence that Mr. Minton Stanley and Mr. Stanley had opportunities to work elsewhere, as well as other city venues, how does that impact your argument regarding affecting their liberty interest?
Well, the question then gets to be, to what extent are these opportunities realistic? And that was the subject of much testimony at trial, which said that they were very rare, most of these venues that the city named and didn't present any testimony regarding the viability of these venues, but most of these venues are small theaters that do not use stagehands. They use perhaps amateurs, but they're such small facilities that they don't need the stagehands, the kind of work that these two men did, which is very specific and very high skilled.
Well, I guess my question is, if the evidence showed that they did, in fact, work at some venues after not being allowed to work at the Waikiki Shell or Neil Blaisdell, how does the fact that they were able to actually perform work in other places, as Mr. Sherwood represented, how does that impact your argument?
Well, there's no question that there was some minor, insignificant employment opportunities available. Dr. Laudat took into account the income that the people had before and after the ban. The question is whether this is a significant is the word that's used in the Green case, significant impingement. It doesn't have to be a total impingement. Green was able to earn 25% of as much as he had earned before, doing some kind of less exciting, less professional work. The fact that these two stagehands got occasional work, incidental, not enough to sustain them, not enough to make a living, doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a total loss of total income. That's not required. One thing I'd like to point out in closing is reputation. It isn't the reputation that's damaged so much of the individuals as the city. The reputation of the city for open, transparent government is ruined by this kind of situation. Everybody knows that there's implications that the mayor's brother was mad. He tried to go outside with another stagehand. The implications that there's something going on beyond what's open and what's showed and what's going on is the problem with this case. Government has to be transparent and open. If it doesn't have a hearing, if it does things behind closed doors, it makes government's reputation damaged. And this case damages government's reputation if it's permitted to go on. One of the things that we talked about was the mayor's involvement. And this works out to an important factor in what was discussed with Mr. Sherwood. The testimony at the preliminary hearing was that Mr. Quintel suggested to the mayor, of all people, that the ban be reconsidered in 9 months. And the implication, the way it's worded, the way he testified, he was saying, why don't we do this? And the mayor said no. And the mayor's involvement is therefore proved by this strange testimony on another subject. It looks bad. It makes the city look so bad. And the other thing that makes the city look so bad is that the defect that caused the mayor's song to be interrupted for a couple seconds, that defect turned out to be what? a defect in an obsolete sound system that was horribly worn out, and that's what really caused the defect. It had nothing to do with K-Fly Lyons, the stagehand who went out on stage to repair a defect in the guitar, the direct input, the DI, which was in turn also caused by obsolete, decrepit material and connections in the Blaisdell, which were shortly thereafter replaced with a new sound system. So what the city's doing is it's scapegoating and preventing its own reputation from being ruined by blaming somebody else. And this is something that promoters don't want. They don't want to be told who they can employ. And that's why the city's reputation is implicated by this kind of improper action.
What are your views on the qualified immunity issue with regard to the two employees?
Well, to be frank about it, I don't really care about the two individuals because the city is liable anyway. But I think that what I was just saying, that there's so much implication that Quintel was following directives that from the mayor that he didn't even honestly believe in, that too shows that he didn't do it in good faith.
There's nothing further. Thank you to both our counsel here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.